Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well webinar and podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden. For those of you who are return attendees, welcome back. Always great and appreciate you taking the time to spend time with us and take part in this conversation, this interactive conversation with a global thought leader. And for those of you who are new to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast universe, welcome, a very warm welcome. Thrilled with the ongoing support that we receive for the podcast. It is currently rated in the top 5% of podcasts around the world. And it's because of amazing guests like Gary, who we'll meet shortly, as well as your ongoing interest, participation, and feedback that allows that to happen. So very excited to start the conversation shortly. And the Do Good to Lead Well podcast series came through before the publication of my first book, Do Good to Lead Well, The Science and Practice of Positive Leadership, where I was really excited to share the conversations I was having with best-selling authors, top global researchers with the world. And at the start of the global pandemic, back in March 2020, I rebooted the series and was speaking with top global CEOs so that we could learn from their extraordinary insight, experience, and expertise. And so this is really the purpose of this community and conversation, so that we can learn from each other and be inspired by each other as well. And so I've been looking forward to this conversation for as long as I can remember. As soon as I connected with Gary, he's just such an extraordinarily authentic, inspiring, and passionate senior executive and chief executive. And I'm going to provide a brief bio. I can't capture everything. He is the chairman emeritus at the WD-40 company. He's also a best-selling author and native Australian. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of San Diego, where he teaches the principles and practices of corporate culture in the Master of Science in Executive Leadership program. Love his philosophy on company culture, and it's based on Aristotle's quote, "Pleasure in the job puts perfection in the work." And just to give you some brief highlights about Gary's extraordinary success, this led to incredible impacts on the bottom line. So under his leadership, WD-40 company grew their market cap from $250 million to nearly $2.5 billion. And their annual compounded growth rate of total shareholder return was 15%. So he shared his lessons in world-class organizational culture by authoring several books. And here you go. That's his. The three books, and they're absolutely jam-packed with fabulous actionable insights and really inspiring actions that we can take. The three books are The Unexpected Learning Moment, Lessons in Leading a Thriving Culture Through Lockdown 2020, Tribe Culture, How It Shaped WD-40 Company. He also co-authored a book with Kim Blanchard, and I referenced this earlier. It's called Helping People Win at Work, a business philosophy called Don't Mark My Paper, Help Me Get an A. Again, fantastic. His extraordinary success as an organizational culture expert has been profiled in numerous best-selling books, including Leading with Gratitude, a former VIP webinar guest, Chester Hilton and Adrian Gostick. He's been named one of the top 10 most admired CEOs in the world by Inc. magazine. Simon Sinek has called him Igniter of the Year, Global Gurus in 2021, put him at number 9 in the list of the top leadership experts in the world. And I believe this says so much about Gary and who he is. His favorite statistic from the engagement surveys that they conducted was that 98.3% of employees under his leadership said they love to tell people they work for WD-40 company. So how awesome is that? And you have a new book that I'd love to open with. You talked about, Gary, but welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast.
Well, g'day, Craig. With all of that, I'm sure you're talking about somebody else, because my normal self-introduction is, g'day, I'm Gary Ridge. I'm the consciously incompetent, probably wrong and luckily right, now chairman emeritus of WD-40 and the culture coach. So I don't know who you were reading about there. Some other Aussie bloke, I think. But yes, correct. I am working on another book. It should be out at the beginning of the next year. It's got a very interesting title that I'll share with you. But the title is really aimed at what culture is all about. And the title is Any Dumb Ass Can Do It. And I consider myself probably one of the best dumb asses in the world. And, you know, if you can really, really engage the fact that it's not about you, it's about the people you have the privilege to lead, you can create great cultures. So looking forward to doing that. And thank you so much. It's great for two people who are part of the Commonwealth to be together today. So God save the king.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And again, and one of the things that I love about each of your books is that the spirit, the energy that you exhibit, which I find when you're reading books, you know, having that synergy. So it's just like having a conversation with you, which I value. And I want to build on the point that you just made, because this is one of there are lots of fantastic quotes in your book. This is one of my favorites, where you're talking about how to build a world-class organizational culture. And then you say, the process is simple, but it's not easy. And that to me is just jam-packed with wisdom. Walk us through what that means.
I like to talk about that as kind of like my petri dish of culture. And when I was in high school in Australia, many, 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 many years ago, my science teacher gave me a petri dish and he said, we're going to grow culture in this petri dish. And when you think about it, there are two things that are really important when you're growing culture. And one of them is, what are the ingredients you put in the petri dish? And I think most leaders and most can identify, you know, what might you need to put in the petri dish to grow great culture? Things like a people first mindset, being a coach, not a manager, having a clearly defined authentic purpose, having a hierarchical set of values, being transparent and having a simple vision, having learning moments that reduce fear, making sure that there's belonging, connectedness, acceptance, and an atmosphere where people matter, and that you care about your people, you're candid with them, you're accountable, and you're responsible. So that's the easy part. We can all identify that. Throw all that in the petri dish, no problem. Here's the hard part. As a leader, you have to love your people enough, not only to reward and applaud them for treating the good ingredients so they grow, but you have to be brave enough consistently to identify and treat the toxins that get in that petri dish. And that's where the hard part comes, because most leaders protect their own comfort zone at the expense of other people's development.
Yeah, so incredible. And I love that point in terms of the petri dish and those pieces that you lay out. And I'm excited that we're going to have the chance to unpack so many of them during our conversation. And I love the point about the toxins. And I'm over, and thank you. Someone's already taken advantage of the opportunity to ask you a question. And I was going to share that. Gary has kindly agreed to take questions from the live audience. So jump in. This is one of the chances to access one of the top organizational culture and celebrated chief executives in the world. So please go ahead. So they loved your point about the toxins in the petri dish. Their concern is, and their name is David, we have a toxic high performer. What do you do? How do you deal with that? Because people are reluctant to intervene because they're afraid of what impact it's going to have. So any insight on that one?
Oh, I have a simple insight. You share them with a competitor. here's the reason why, because that toxic high performer is sending a very clear message to the organization. And that message is, if I'm a high performer, I don't have to worry about our values. I don't have to treat people with respect and dignity. The only thing that matters here is short-term results. So I can be the biggest a-hole in the world as long as I'm delivering. And if that happens, you get toxins spreading at pandemic rates, because now everybody says, well, it doesn't matter here. All they're worried about here is the result. That'll get you a short-term result. As Simon Sinek would say, that's not playing the infinite game.
Right. You also use the word, one of the things I really appreciate about reading your books is that you talk about, you intentionally use the word try. So I'd love for you to talk about why you describe that, the culture in that way, and how that really captures the essence of what you speak about and how you lead.
Sure. So there are many desires we have as human beings. One of the desires we have, which is so prominent in us, is we need to belong. We want to belong. We want to belong and we want to know we matter. And I know that everybody who's either listening to us today or listening to a recording of this have left either an organization, a party, or even a relationship because they didn't feel like they belong. So if we go back thousands of years, we are tribal as human beings. You know, when I talk about a tribe, I'm not referring to any specific indigenous group. What I'm referring to is the behaviors of tribalism. Now, having said that, when I was thinking about tribes many years ago, I did want to understand how, you know, groups of people stayed together thousands of years ago in harsh conditions. And I went and I studied some of the tribal behaviors of the Indigenous Australians and the Fijian Islanders. And one of the things that became very clear to me is there are attributes of a tribe that are very important. And I got this from both. So let me explain it kind of with a little story, in that let's go in a time machine and go back thousands of years, and let's be in the middle of my homeland, Australia, and let's be observing a group of Indigenous Australians. What would the tribal leader be doing? The tribal leader would be teaching those within the tribe to throw a boomerang. Why? Because the boomerang was the tool of survival. So that was very clear. And I also got the same feedback when I sat in Fiji, in one of the Fijian islands, and spoke to some tribe members, and they said, you know, what we need to do is be learners and teachers. We need to teach our tribe members how to be great fishermen and great, you know, and great hunters. So the number one tribal responsibility of a tribal leader is to be a learner and a teacher. The number two is to have a compelling set of values that protect and set the tribe free. Number three is you have to create the culture of belonging, and that means showing people that they matter. Another attribute is the tribal leader has to be future focused. In other words, they have to be aware of how the environment around them is changing. And wasn't that something that we learned a lot during the, you know, the journey of COVID? Number four, we know that they have to have specialized skills. So we know that a tribe is made up of people of different skills. For example, better fishermen, better hunters, better house builders. You know, we have sales, marketing, supply chain quality. They have to be warriors. In other words, they have to have a warrior spirit. And then finally, there has to be celebration. So these are the attributes of what I see are the true essence of having a tribe where people come together. And our tribal promise at WD-40 Company was a group of people that come together to protect and feed each other. That's why we went to work every day. That was our just cause.
Well, and thank you for such a powerful answer, Gary. And what I love, and this is something throughout the book, as I mentioned, is that not only do you so clearly capture the core principles about how we build a very strong culture of belonging, and I love those words that you select. On top of that, you tell us how to do it, and you provide concrete actions, which I think are just incredibly important, because sometimes you can hear these ideas and sentiments, and then it's, okay, how do I do that? And I love you provide a roadmap. One of them, and again, I love the framing of it and the definition. So can you walk us through learning moment? That was part of the title of your book around leading through COVID. I love the fullness of what a learning moment represents. Can you talk to us about it and how organizational leaders can capitalize on this practice?
Yeah, thanks. So let's go back to the birth of the learning moment. You know, one of the things that disables us as human beings is fear. You know, if you think about a deer crossing the road, he turns, there's headlights coming, you know, they get paralyzed by fear, bang, the deer gets hit and it dies. So I believe that most people in organizations don't lie. I believe they fake and hide. Why do they fake and hide? Because they have a fear of failure. If we think about how we learn a little bit by theory. We learn a little bit more by practice, but we learn a lot from mistakes or experiences. So why would we want to have an organization where people fear making mistakes? Because we're all going to make them. We're all going to make them. You know, I have this statement where I get up and say, I've never made a mistake in my life, but I've had millions of learning moments. So what we did is we took the word failure out of our vocabulary and we replaced it with learning moments. And the learning moment definition is a positive or negative outcome of any situation that has to be openly and freely shared to benefit all people. So now people come and say, I just had this learning moment. I tried this. This was my outcome. I didn't quite get what I wanted, but I need to share this with people in the organization so they don't have the repeatable learning moment. So the whole basis of the learning moment, Craig, is to take away fear. Because again, if you don't have belonging and you don't have freedom, you don't have entrepreneurialism, psychological safety. It all comes around people who, you know, are lying, faking and hiding. They're not really lying. They're faking and hiding because of this fear of making a mistake. Because, you know, they have this person in their business, which is Al, the soul sacking CEO, who must always be right.
Well, I love the label. Your titles are fantastic. I can have a conversation with, I just, you know, any dumbass can do it. Are you an accidental soul sucking CEO? And I want to ask you about that. And to me, what I love about the learning moment, you talk about the fear, and I just find that so prevalent and couldn't agree more about how impactful that is and how strongly it holds us back. And so to create that environment of safety. And the thing I love most, on top of the framing of it, that it's also positive. Because a lot of times they just dive into, well, let's talk about all the bad things that happened, even if it's framed see you shaking your head. Talk a little bit more about that, because to me, that's just such a brilliant piece, because it's both sides of the spectrum.
Well, it goes back to one of the ingredients in the Petri dish, which is, you know, learning and experiment, and one of the attributes of a tribal culture to celebrate. So let's reward and applaud for doing great work. Why shouldn't we celebrate? So, you know, we used to celebrate significant positive learning moments because we all benefited from them. So we make heroes out of it. You know, I remember early in my time as CEO, you know, I was 25 years as a public company CEO, as you know. And early in my time, I wanted to encourage people to share learning moments, but naturally it wasn't natural for them. What's going to happen when I share this? So it was interesting. I ran a program for nearly 12 months where I asked people to share with me the positive and negative outcomes of any situation they had. And in the first couple of months, I got very few people who were going to share. But what I did is I made heroes of them. Those that did share, I celebrated them. I made heroes of them. I worshiped them as being people that, you know, were really showing us what we want. And suddenly the number of people who were sharing went up and up. And now you can walk through our company and hopefully others that have adopted the learning moment. Here people say, I just had a learning moment. Let me share it with you, which is so powerful.
And again, I think that's so wonderful. And as you talk about the accidental soul-sucking CEO, do you hoard information? Do you keep things in? And I love that emphasis on, well, we all win, we all thrive. When we share our wins with each, we celebrate them. And then also there's tremendous power and opportunity in letting people know what we figured out or what our challenges are. So then they can either help us or build on that and replicate the success. I just think that's fantastic. I do want to talk about the accidental CEO. And we've got another few questions in the queue. So can't wait to share them with you, Gary. You talked about Are you an accidental soul-sucking CEO? So can you talk about the accidental parts and then how that happens, how we can avoid becoming one?
Well, you know, what I learned over time is a lot of leaders have Al's attributes. They just haven't realized the impact of those attributes. So I call it accidental because I truly believe that most people don't get up every day to hurt people. That's a deep belief of mine. However, the data shows you, Craig, that globally, only about 30% of people, and during COVID, it went down to something like 16% of people go to work every day and are enthusiastic about making a contribution to something bigger than themselves. And that has to be because of the culture, the toxic culture. In fact, during COVID, you know, there was a lot of talk about the Great Resignation. I wrote an article, I called it the Great Escape. People were actually now escaping from toxic cultures. And just the other day, I was having a conversation about people returning to work. And there was a group of people who never had the opportunity not to be at work. You know, you don't make Ford motor cars in your bedroom. And, you know, I'm on the board of a company called Gorilla Glue, great company. And you know, you can't make glue in your garage. So those people are always there. But it was those that were in the offices and whatever. And they said, well, a lot of people are resistant to go back. And I said, you know why? Because it was a toxic culture they escaped from. So what are you saying to them? Come back for another fatal beating in a culture that you don't like? So, you know, I think it gets back to how do we create these great cultures? And a lot of people, a lot of leaders accidentally have Al's attributes or Alice. Let's not be gender specific. It could be Al or Alice. But if you think about these attributes, Al's ego eats his empathy instead of his empathy eating his ego. He thinks micromanagement is essential. They think they're corporate royalty. They love a fear-based culture. There's the learning moment opportunity. A master of control, a know-it-all. They have all the answers, even the wrong answers. They think learning is for losers. They must always be right. They hate feedback and they don't follow through consistently with their commitments. Now, the accidental soul-sucking CEO has these, but it's a matter of identifying them and then deciding to do something about them.
Well, and again, what I love about the books that you've written and what you share in your articles and elsewhere is that, and two of the elements of a fearless tribe, you talk about care and candor. And I love that in the answer, right, that you just provided in terms of just that ability to be able to engage in that way, pull on both of those pieces. And one doesn't operate in isolation of the other. So I think that's...
And it gets back to what our responsibility is. You know, as you probably know, we got rid of the word manager. We call everybody a coach. Now, if you think about your role as a leader as being a coach, let's think about it as if you were coaching a football team. I have never, ever seen the coach of an A-grade football team run onto the field and kick a goal. They don't do it. Their job is to be on the sideline observing the play. Firstly, they need to know what it takes to win in that game. The goal posts need to be very clear. And they observe the play and their job is to advise the player. Secondly, they spend a lot of time in the locker room. What are they doing in the locker room? They're building trust, building collaboration around the team. Now, imagine if you had a football game and there were no goalposts. Number one, no goalposts. Number two, it didn't have a time limit, but you put all the players on the field. What would you get at the end of that? You would get a lot of tired people who had no sense of achievement. So our goal as a coach is, where are the goalposts? Do we agree where they are? And my job is to help you play your best game ever, because I got up this morning to help you play your best game. And that's what we talk with Ken Blanchard, which is, I'm not here to mark your paper. I'm here to help you get an A. Or I'm not here to play your game. I'm here to help you win.
It's amazing. And I love that. And those shifts are incredibly powerful in terms of the mindset, the frame that we're using, and also the environment that we create and the sense of belonging, as as you talk about. We've got a question from Gregory, who said, love your focus on values. Our organization is kind of thinking about how we identify our values. And so any lessons learned, how do we do that? How do we blend the values that define our organization? How can the senior leadership team do this effectively?
Well, there are four stages, Craig. There's design, adapt, adopt, and embed. Now, in the design phase, it's very inclusive. So what you would do is list your own values, which should include descriptive behavioral language. So you can see when that value is being adopted or not. Then you would engage your leadership team to explore that list and make additions and adjustments. Do not compromise your own values, but they can be additive to, you know, whatever that conversation is. Then you involve the entire company to review that drafted set of values, and that's where you adapt it to whatever the organization is. And then the leadership then again comes back and refines them, and then you keep working on them until you have at least 80% people who are nodding their head and saying, these are the sort of values that are meaningful for me. These values will set me free. These values will protect me. And then you have to embed them in the organization. And embedding means you incorporate the values day to day in how you make business decisions. And you're very vocal about that. And in the book, Helping People Win at Work, we actually include the values in our talent development program, where we ask our leaders and our coaches to share with us, how did they live our now embedded values in the last 90 days with true examples. And by doing that, you embed it in the behavior. And then finally, they need to be hierarchical. So people can't cherry pick the value to the situation. So your number one and number two value at least need to be more powerful than the number four or five. And you should only have four, five, or six, no more than that. And integrity and words like that are not values, they're prerequisites. Values describe desired behavior. Seth Godin says values are people like us do things like this.
Well, and thank you. I've got so many comments about that. It's an amazing answer and definition. And what I love, Gary, about what you share is around translating them into behaviors. So what are the observable expressions of those? And I had the amazing good fortune to collaborate with Alan Mulally, as you know, on my latest book. And then he talks about authentic leadership, where values, beliefs, and behaviors are in alignment, and all people see are your behaviors. And I mean, it's just such an extraordinary overlap, right, in terms of we've got to be thoughtful. I love you take it to that level, because a lot of times there's this talk about values, yet, and I have this discussion often where it's like the behavior, you look at the values, then the behaviors, there's like this massive disconnect.
Yeah, and you have to be able to put those values to work in decisions that you make, because the true value of values is they protect you and they set you free. And what I mean by set you free, we've said for many years, anyone in the company at any level should be able to make any decision they need to make if they just use our values to make that decision, instead of having to quack up the hierarchy, you know. Quack, quack, quack. I've got to talk to my supervisor. Quack, quack, quack. I've got to talk to my boss. Quack, quack, quack. And then you get to the King Mallard. Quack, quack. You know, you've reached the top of the hierarchy, and there are all hours sitting on the top waiting to be in command and control. Now, we need to distribute the authority through values.
Well, and I love that point. Again, it was such a rich insight in the book around, well, what values do above and beyond providing that navigational compass, like our true north, if you will. And it frees us up, the energy and then the effort and the questioning. And now we can really, and I love the linkage to the decision. Okay, in this situation, because I know intimately what our values are and how they're expressed, okay, we do the right thing at WD-40 Company. Now I know what that looks like. I have a strong sense and I don't have to move. Allison was going to ask about the hierarchical value side, and you touched on that. Now Allison was wondering, like, how do you figure that out? Like, how do you go through the prioritization process? Like, how do you rank them in terms of order of importance. Can you share a little bit of your experience or insight, any advice for how they can do it?
Well, yeah. So if I use WD-40 as my point of reference, our number one value is we value doing the right thing. Our number two value is we value creating positive, lasting memories in all of our relationships. Those two values are very, very linked to our culture. We want to do the right thing. And if you look at our why statement as an organization, why do we exist? We say we exist to create positive, lasting memories by solving problems in factories, homes, and workshops in the world. We solve problems, we create opportunities. So I can give you a really clear example of how this can work. Our number sixth value at the company was we value sustaining the WD-40 economy, which basically means we have to be an economy that is successful to be able to not only feed and fund the infrastructure, but we also have to respect our shareholders. Now, as a public company, you think our number one value might be, our number one drive would be the profitability. Well, if we live our values, that's a deliverable. And here's an example. We have a mandatory at WD-40 that we will have no cancer-causing chemicals in any product we make. So an example might be someone works in procurement or in supply chain and the vendor comes along and says, hey, Craig, I can save you X millions of dollars if you were to replace this chemical with this one. It says its performance, it performs very well. This, you know, your end users are going to get exactly the same, you know, outcome. It's going to create a positive lasting memory for you. And there's only one thing you have to do is if you use this chemical, you've got to put in California, they call it a Prop 65 warning, which is a warning on the can that this contains a chemical that known to California may cause cancer. So this person in supply chain says, no, thank you. Thanks for offering it to me. But wait a minute, Craig, you can save $4 million. Hey, thanks very much. Appreciate that. But we're not going to do it. Well, wait a minute. Why? Well, because we have a value. Our number one value is we value doing the right thing, and that's not doing the right thing. And cancer doesn't create any positive lasting memories. And the person says, Craig, I want to talk to your boss because, you know, you don't know that this is a thing about profitability. I said, Craig, you can talk to my boss. You can talk to the chairman of the board. You can talk to anyone you like. You're going to get exactly the same answer because it's our values that create. Now, if these weren't hierarchical, let's say that they were, you know, any way you want, the person could go and say, you know, I'm going to make that decision because it's going to enhance the WD-40 economy. So I've actually lived our value, but you forgot the two that are most important to us. So that's a true example of how a clearly defined set of hierarchical values set people free.
There's so many things that are so powerful to take from that example, not just, okay, what decision do I make? Also, I love how the answer back to the supplier, here are our values and this is how it, and then no matter where you go, this is repeated and understood, regardless of how much you escalate this up the chain, it's going to be the same answer. So I think that's so great. I've got a clarification question from Stan, who said, I love this discussion of hierarchy of values. I hear about values and not about hierarchy. Am I correct in assuming that it's the senior leadership team that does that? Like who ranks them?
Yeah, I think in the development of them, certainly we would ask our people, which value do you think is more important to us than, you know, so we would ask the broader group to give us their feedback. And what we did it, interestingly enough, we were all very clearly aligned. You know, we, again, when we put the values out for the adoption phase, which is for feedback, you need to make sure that whatever you're saying has a definition. So we, you know, if you read in at the unexpected learning moment, I share the values and I share the definition. I say, this is what doing the right thing means, right? And that's so important because if you just had that one line, it's, well, what's doing the right thing? You're doing the right thing in Canada may be different from doing the right thing in China, may be different from doing the right thing in fill in the blank. So we need to say, as an organization, wherever we are in the world, this is what it means. And those definitions are so important.
Well, and I couldn't agree more. What I love is linking it back to several of your points before about being a learning organization. And then also I love your discussion about being a coach versus a manager, which is here are the guideposts. So then by articulate breaking that down, it provides a much more powerful and clear-cut way about, okay, so here are the things that I'm considering when I'm making this decision, and now really solidifies that organizational culture. I've got another question from Tim, who's wondering about, so in this day and age, what role does vulnerability have in terms of being an effective executive, and how much is too much? So looking for some guidance there.
You may remember when I, in a humorous way, introduced myself. I'm the consciously incompetent, probably wrong and roughly right. And vulnerability is so important. You know, one of Al's behaviors is he must always be right. He's not vulnerable. So, but you know, at the end of the day, Craig, we are just these basic human beings bumbling our way down this pathway of life. Nothing's perfect. So to show that to people that we're human, we're vulnerable, is so important. It's authenticity. So I think vulnerability is, you know, that's when your ego gets in the way. I am so, so incompetent. It's unbelievable. And the three most important words I ever learned in my life are, I don't know. And I got real comfortable with saying, look, I don't know, but I'm sure if we all get together, we can work this out. And you talk to Alan Mulally, what would he say? The three most important words are, I don't know. But I tell you what, we can get together and work it out together. So I think vulnerability is so important. I mean, we're just, you know, you would think after, you know, 25 years as a CEO, I'd work this out. I actually have to have on my little notebook here, and I have it on my computer screen, this little note thing. And it says, am I being the person I want to be right now? And then it says, who is that person? And I look at this, I don't know how many times a day, because I have to remind myself not to be the accidental, you know, soul-sucking leader now. And it says, who's the person? Who do I want to be? I want to be grateful. I want to be caring. I want to be empathetic. I want to be reasonable. I want to be a listener. I want to be fact-based. I want to have a balanced opinion. I want to be curious. I want to be a learner. And I want to throw sunshine, not a shadow. Now, you would think after doing this for 25 years, I would have worked it out, wouldn't you? But I'm just human. I haven't worked it out. I have to keep reminding myself. And this is the sort of stuff that our friend Alan Marshall Goldsmith talks about all the time. And, you know, again, the daily questions. He's been asking himself daily questions for as long as I've known him. And he has someone call him up and hold him accountable for things that, you know, he accidentally steps off the path into the bushes where these thieves are.
Yes. And what I'm struck by in speaking with the most globally respected chief executive and thought leaders is they have extraordinarily powerful, simple, like, practices. And yet it's the dedication and the commitment to continue to use them and recognize, hey, no matter where I am in the world, no matter what's happening right now, no matter what news conference I'm at or what title, you know, what cover story is being written, it's this ruthless resolve. That's so inspirational, right? Where you say, I've got to come back to this every single day.
You open our conversation with it's simple, not easy.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, culture is values plus behavior times consistency. That's it. This is simple. It's not easy. And time is not your friend.
Well, and I love the questions. Again, there's such a powerful set of questions. Am I being the person I want to be right now? And you talked about the sense of gratitude. And one of the chapters in your latest book, The Unexpected Learning Moment, was around, you had a chapter on gratitude through pandemic. And so can you talk a little bit about the thought process of writing that chapter and some of the things that you were grateful for? Because going through that and you acknowledge it, it's like, okay, that might seem a little different. I just thought it was great that you took that orientation.
Yeah, you know, when I look back and as we were going through COVID, I started to make a list I was adding to it every day of what I was really grateful for. And, you know, the guru of gratitude, our dear friend, Chester Elton, you know, he's a great friend of mine. But when you think about it, you know, you've got to think about the gratitude of purpose. You know, why do we have, you know, that purpose and how grateful we are that we do have a purpose. The gratitude of our company values. I was so grateful that we had those in place as we went through COVID because we referred to them every time. The gratitude of a collaborative culture. You know, we had that culture of collaboration. The gratitude for being focused and knowing what we wanted to do. The gratitude of having good data. You know, and the gratitude of grace. Just being able to show grace. And, you know, John Baldoni just wrote a great book. I don't know if you know John or not, but he said it's called Grace Under Pressure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no more time that you need grace, more importantly, than when things are pressure. And, you know, the gratitude for this, for the compassion on this crazy ride we're on. You know, what was clear to me is the person that you said, see you Monday morning to in March 2020. Mm-hmm. is not the same person that you would see in person in September of 2021 or 2022. They'd all been through their own personal hero's journey. So we needed to make sure we showed gratitude for that reconnection.
Thank you. And again, lots of throughout this whole conversation, the comment box has just been overwhelmed with thank you. This is awesome. Really insightful. I love that you highlighted being grateful for the values, because another really powerful lesson that you share, and I think it's so important to recognize, is that how the values assisted decision-making. And it doesn't make them easier. It doesn't make, hey, no worries. What it does, though, is provide a really strong navigational compass as we're balancing some really complex and challenging things. And as leaders, it frees us up now to really focus on that versus if we don't have them, well now, and you share about the business cases that you provide where people are arguing about what's most important.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, when you reflect about the unexpected learning moment of COVID is the uncertainty. And a dear friend of mine, Dr. Rebecca Homkes, who is from the London Business School, she gave you a great definition of uncertainty during COVID. She says, it's a series of future events that may or may not occur. And you know what? Most of them didn't occur.
For
some
sure,
of them did, were terrible, of course. But yeah, that's where uncertain, we can deal with risk. You know, we're pretty good as humans dealing with risk, but it's uncertain. You know, I've described the journey that we went through then and we went through now. A bit like flying an aeroplane. You know, Craig, let's think about flying an aeroplane or getting to a destination. So the first thing we say, where do we want to go? Well, of course, we need to know that in a business. We're going to go from point A to point B. Great. What do we need? We need an aeroplane to fly there. Okay. What is the aeroplane? The aeroplane is the structure of our business. So as leaders, we've got to, is the aeroplane in good condition? Do we have enough fuel on board? Have we checked the engines? Do the tires have air in them? But then that aeroplane's going nowhere without the crew. So, you know, we have to make sure that we've got a well-trained crew. So we're ready to go. So the captain, you know, calls in and says, here's my flight path. And there's two things that can affect this flight, headwinds and tailwinds. So we've all flown businesses where we've had headwinds. And what does that mean? It takes a little longer to get there and you use a bit more fuel. And we've all had times when we have tailwinds, which we get there a little sooner. And we use a little less fuel. So what happens when we take off is the captain says to us, keep your seatbelt on. I think we're going to have a good flight. And, you know, but we might hit some turbulence, but we don't know. And COVID was a series of turbulence. We hit turbulence. We didn't know it was there. How long was it going to go on? And if you think about turbulence, it's wild. It's rough. It's unstable. It's a roller coaster. It's unsettled. It's chaotic. What are people doing as the crew? They're working harder. The captain's front, people get exhausted. You know, maybe we got to land the plane and rest for a little while before we take off again. So, well, we're still going to the same destination. To me, COVID and even business after that with inflation and all that's going on in the world, it's all about the turbulence that we're going through. Now, if you don't take care of the plane and you don't take care of the crew, there is no way you're going to get through that turbulence. That's a fact. You still know where you want to go. The destination's still the same, but you've got to take care of the plane and the crew. Otherwise, it's never going to get to its destination, particularly in a time of extreme turbulence.
What? I love that example. It's so powerful. It's such a powerful visual, and you can really so clearly see how that culture of belonging is essential. If we're in that, going through the turbulence, And if there are people there yelling and screaming and all kind of, you know, those toxins in the petri dish, how can you possibly make it through these circumstances if we're not working together to figure it out, treating each other respectfully and feel like, hey, I belong here and I value where we're flying. Because if we don't know, back to your core piece around wealth building a desirable future and our purpose. So I love that. And Todd Churches, we had on, a best-selling author, he wrote Visual Leadership and the Power of Metaphor and Visuals. It's just such a masterclass in providing that. So thank you, Gary. We're almost at time. I can't believe this. We're just, time is flying. This has been great. One other piece, because there's so much conversation. I've had this discussion, certainly as we've turned the corner on COVID-19, the pandemic, around accountability and how we raise accountability and responsibility in organizations. And I know what I, again, another invaluable part of the book, you talk about the four pillars of the Fearless Tribe, and accountability and responsibility are two of those. Can you break them down for us? Because I think there's just so much insight in that for us as business leaders, as human beings, and how we approach those conversations and that topic.
Yeah, and I think accountability is a big thing in this, in that most people let people down because they're not clear about what they're going to hold each other accountable for. Or as Ken Blanchard and I wrote, what does an A look like? So, you know, if an A was to walk in the room today and my goal as a coach is to help you get that A, what does it look like? So it's pretty simple. You know, people need to know accountability is doing what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it, to the standard you're supposed to do it to. And I think in most cases, we're not clear on those three things. And Dr. Amber Selkin, who is the team's mental performance coach at Notre Dame and the Denver Broncos, that's how she describes accountability. It's what are you supposed to do? When are you supposed to do it? And what is the standard you're supposed to do it to? Now, again, it's a bit like not having the goalposts on the on the soccer field. That's what accountability is. Take those goalposts away and you don't score. So, you know, that's really important. What does an A look like? Have you been clear? What do I expect from you? And what do you expect from me? That's the other thing. It's a two-way street. And then my job as the coach is to help you win. That's the only reason I get up every day, is to help you win.
And again, I love that comment around, so what does an A look like? And then, and a critical reflective question, which is, okay, what do you need for me to get there? Because a lot of times it's like, well, how are you going to do that for me? And again, in a culture of belonging where we're all together, well, then how can I support you in getting to where we both want you to go? Because this is an important outcome for us.
And responsibility, you know, we wrote an interesting thing at the company called the Maniac Pledge. This is a pledge that we take around responsibility. Let me share it with those that are with us today and those that are listening in the future. Here's what it says. It says, it starts off with three words. I am responsible for taking action, asking questions, getting answers, and making decisions. I won't wait for someone to tell me. If I need to know, I am responsible for asking. I have no right to be offended that I didn't get this sooner. And if I'm doing something others should know about, I am responsible for telling you. It's the permission statement.
I love the Maniac Pledge. I think it's brilliant. And if organizations, if community members, families, we embrace that, right? In terms of, hey, look at what I'm responsible for and how I can go out and access the information and build the relationships that are important to me. Again, you can see how that culture of belonging and that culture of excellence is formed. So, and I've just got a bunch of love the Maniac Pledge. I am going to write the Maniac Pledge and share it far and wide. So this is terrific. There are many HR executives and CHROs who listen in and share their feedback. And I know you've wrote a fabulous chapter around, so how do you have a strong relationship? And so you do a great job of talking about a topic that often I don't find discussed. So can you share some of your tips, techniques to do that?
Well, I think it was pretty simple for me is that the person responsibility for culture sat at the leadership table. You know, they were a core member of our what we called our drive, our global tribal council, which was our, if a lot of people call it the senior executive group, I called it the global tribal council. And they sat at the leadership table. You know, most heads of human resources, which is a terrible, terrible name, don't sit at the leadership table. With us, they did, because it was the people that was as important as the folks who wrote the marketing plan, the legal department that kept us, you know, from not doing the right things, the production crew, the whoever, the CFO. So our CHRO sat at the table and was involved in everything, because again, see, you can have the best strategic plan in the world, but if you have low will of the people, it's a multiplier effect. Write your strategic plan, take it over to Sunbreak University. They'll give you 80 out of 100. Beautiful, great strategic plan. But if only 20% of your people go to work every day and are passionate about making a contribution to something bigger than themselves, about knowing that they matter, knowing that they belong, about learning something new and about being protected and set free by a compelling set of values and going home happy, which is the most important thing, because organizations with great people and great culture send people home happy, and happy people create happy families create happy communities, and happy communities create a happy world. And don't tell me we don't need a happier world right now, because we do. So businesses have a responsibility today, bigger than ever before. We can change the world by taking out the toxic cultures of this person, Alice, the accidental soul sucking CEO.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm going to reference Alice so often, and I can think of, we're almost at time. I can't think of a better question to end this with. Gary, and again, thank you so, so much. So Lynn just wrote in and said, I cannot remember a webinar that was more inspiring and valuable than this one. So thank you so, so much. Just wondering about, how do you protect culture in a remote environment and in a hybrid world? Any thoughts, insights that you can share?
It's the values. It's the end of that. Values are the fence around the culture. So again, remember the algorithm. Culture equals values plus behavior times consistency. So embed the values in the organization as to protect people and set them free.
Love that. Well, thank you. And also same thing. Love that. That's so powerful. As we come up on time, I'm going to announce and thank you. This is just unbelievable. The number of positive comments and just your passion for positive leadership is incredible.
Sure.
Just say,
Craig, if anybody wants to stay connected, please follow me on LinkedIn. I post articles there. You can find me, G-A-R-R-Y, Ridge, R-I-D-G-E, on LinkedIn. I just love sharing my learning on there, and I've written several articles, and there'll be some information there once the new book's out, but please join the family.
It's wonderful, and well, definitely throw to you for final comments as well, because this has just been terrific, and I couldn't agree more in terms of checking, you know, looking at your blog posts on LinkedIn, and all of the content and your books, which as I shared are exceptional. So before we close off, Gary, any other final words, insights? This has just been exceptionally valuable. I've learned so much through the books. I've learned more through our conversation. And any parting words before we say our goodbyes today?
Yeah, well, parting words, life is a gift. Don't send it back unwrapped.
That's amazing. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Gary, for your time and your passion and your contributions. And to everyone else, looking forward to seeing you on a future program. And yes, go on LinkedIn right away and start following Gary. And I keep waiting to read, Any Dumbass Can Do It. That's just the best title of a book in 2024. Take care, everyone. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden, or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.